Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show we're going to review the debut solo album from Jenny Beth, who's the singer in one of our favorite bands, Savages. And Jim, you in particular have been eagerly awaiting this one.
I have, Mr. Cott. I'm not going to tip my hand because we'll get into the context and our opinions later in the show. First, though, we are revisiting an interview we conducted in 2018. Ray Padgett is a music writer and publicist who's run the Cover Me blog since 2007. His blog highlights a wide variety of notable cover songs that span genres from soul to punk and everything in between. He also wrote a book of the same theme called Cover Me, The Stories Behind the Greatest Cover Songs of All Time. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
Ray, where does the term cover come from?
The term cover came around in the late 40s. The idea, basically, it was an industry thing where record labels would try to have their own version of a big hit. So if Frank Sinatra or whoever has some massive hit, every record label would try to release a sound-alike version, the opposite of what we think of as a cover today, where you make it your own. This is the opposite. They wanted to sound exactly the same. And the idea was literally to cover the original record up in a store shelf. Maybe Frank Sinatra's not a great example, but people back then maybe didn't know who sang every single song they heard on the radio. They just knew the name of the song. So, you know, Mood Indigo. They'd say, I want to buy Mood Indigo. And the record label clerk would just grab whatever version of Mood Indigo was sitting there. Fun fact I learned researching the book is that the Woolworths department store chain had its own record label, the entire purpose of which was to rip off hit songs and put them in their record stores so they made more money rather than selling the original.
Oh, that's insidious.
It's evil.
Wake up, little Susie, wake up. We've both been sound asleep.
Wake up, little Susie, and weep. The movie's over, it's 4 o'clock, and we're in trouble deep. Wake up, little Susie, wake up, little Susie.
We want to dig deep into some of the stories that you tell, which are fascinating, behind some of the best-known covers, I think, in rock history. But before we get there, give us some philosophy, man. What makes a great cover song?
That's a great question. And I'll answer that first by answering the reverse. What makes a bad cover song? Because you constantly see lists of, like, the worst cover songs ever, and it's, you know, Madonna doing American Pie.
I started singing, bye, bye, Miss American Pie.
Oh, that's bad, yeah.
It's bad, but I would argue that the worst cover song is a tie between every cover song that doesn't change anything from the original. Which, to answer your question, so that's the first step in a good cover song, is you have to make it your own. You can't just slavishly record, you know, exactly how the Rolling Stones or whoever did it, because what's the point in that? You have to find something in the song that you love, make it your own, but also be irreverent enough to throw away parts of the original and reinvent them.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Okay, let's hear
certainly
it.
We've all endured innumerable bad cover bands, right?
Oh, yes.
But I had a friend who's a rock academic at DePaul University, and she says one of the things that's happening when a band is covering a song that you love on stage is you're hearing the real band in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're not at the empty bottle seeing the Rolling Stones, right? But I'll also throw at you the Feelies, who are, you know, one of, I think, the most inventive bands in rock in the last 30 years, and they're famous for covering songs. And they're always very faithful, but it illuminates their whole aesthetic by showing where they got bits and pieces of it.
I see a red door and I want to paint it black. No colors anymore, I want them to be black. I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes.
See, I wouldn't call them faithful. I agree with you that they're, and bands like them are, you know, copying certain parts of the original. But I feel like if you're feeling it enough, if you're making it your own, another, you know, sort of famous example would be Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll.
Sure.
Huge song, very famous. And if you compare,
and nobody knew the original.
And if you A-B it to the Arrow's obscure original, it's basically the same. The drum parts are the same. The guitar parts are the same.
I saw her dancing there by the record machine.
she must have been about 17. The beat was going strong, playing my favorite song, and I could tell it wouldn't be long till she was with me. Yeah, me.
And I could tell it wouldn't be long till she was with me. Yeah, me. Singing.
But if you bring a certain passion, a certain dedication, you know, I think that is making it your own, and I think the Feelies are a good example of that.
We're talking to Ray Padgett, the author of Cover Me, the stories behind the greatest cover songs of all time. Kick off your book with Elvis Presley covering Hound Dog. Why'd you lead off the book with that? Why that particular song?
Because I think it sort of marks a transition point in the history of the cover song, and that's what I'm trying to tell throughout the book. Before, you know, the argument is, everything was a cover song sort of before the dawn of rock and roll, or most things. The job title of singer slash songwriter didn't really exist in the same
sure.
way. If you were a singer, you were singing songs that other people had written and often previously recorded. I mean, you could even call every orchestra that performs a Mozart song a cover by some stretch. But Elvis, you know, it's sort of – he never, you know, wrote any of his own songs. And so he's right at the tail end of that tradition, but he's inaugurating a tradition that, you know, follows through to the Beatles and every rock and roll band since, where it soon became a premium to write your own songs. And Elvis, I thought, was an interesting case study of Hound Dog specifically, because that's a song, you know, that's he took from an African-American singer, Big Mama Thornton, who had had sort of a, what at the time were termed race hit, which means, you know, a segregated hit with it.
You!
And he sort of reinvented it, you know, made it about a literal dog for, you know, the sort of broader market. And then it ties into an issue the cover songs have had throughout their history, including way back to Elvis, which is, you know, appropriation.
Well, it's a history of rock and roll, isn't it? It's
yeah.
white artists covering black R&B and performers, gospel performers in some cases, and making it their own and selling it to a broader audience. And, you know, hence the idea of appropriation and, you know, cultural colonialism. In your opinion, is he transforming that song? Is he making it better? What's your focus on that song and the way Elvis sings it versus Big Mama Thornton's original?
Well, he's definitely transforming it. I mean, I think Big Mama Thornton's original is fantastic. It's sort of a rough blues number that I think is great. It didn't need to be fixed or improved. What Elvis does is he sort of makes it almost a novelty song, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but he makes it about a dog, first of all, literal, you know, crying all the time, hound dog, and he just sort of hams it up. It's very upbeat. It's danceable. You know, this is the song where he's shaking his hips on Ed Sullivan, mm-hmm. causing so much controversy. So he totally reinvents it. But I think, like, you know, it's a great cover in the sense that they can both coexist. Lieber and Stoller had a funny quote. They wrote the original song, and they said, Elvis's lyrics don't make any sense. He's singing about a dog, but it's a, you know, a low-down dog. But then they would later add, we hated Elvis's cover, ... until the checks started coming in.
Yeah, right. Ray, tell us, how did Elvis discover Hound Dog?
Then this is another complicating factor in this sort of racial appropriation narrative, is that Elvis may or may not have actually heard Big Mama Thornton's original. He took his interpretation, his version about the dog, from this basically Vegas lounge act, and it was a novelty number for them at the end of the show. You know, dance moves, fancy suits, you know, yucking it up. Elvis was on a Vegas concert of his own. He went and he saw them. He loved it. And so all the lines that Lieber and Stoller were complaining about as being Elvis lines about dogs were actually Freddie Bell lines, but Freddie Bell never had success with it.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, a hound dog. You ain't no friend of mine.
Why is it this iconic song? I mean, it's still, you know, you mentioned Hound Dog. People always associate it with Elvis unless they really know their stuff.
Yeah.
It's really considered like this ground zero for rock and roll in many ways and associated with a white artist who's ripping it off from a lounge singer
who in turn
ripped it off from the originator.
I think it stands out in your book, Ray, as one of the only songs that I think a lot of listeners would not even realize it was a cover.
Yeah.
You know, the others all stand as, you know, original is as big as the cover, but this one Elvis took.
Yeah, he took it, and I agree, it's much bigger. I think it embodies so much of what made Elvis both great and, you know, hugely popular, which is the energy, the attitude, the swagger. You know, it's a tight song, you know, 2.5 minutes. It just sort of races through. And, yeah, I mean, in a way, it's a shame when a cover so eclipses the original that the original gets forgotten in the narrative of music history. I mean, I like I say, I think people should listen to Big Mama Thornton's. I think it has a lot to offer. But, you know, Elvis, especially at the time, was such sort of an all-consuming force that if he did a song, it became an Elvis song, no mm-hmm. matter what it was beforehand.
What did Mama Thornton think about it? Did your research point you in any direction in that regard?
She wasn't thrilled for the simple reason that she hadn't written the original song, which means she didn't make any money off of Elvis's version.
Right.
If you write the original song, you make royalties off of anyone who covers it. But if you performed the original song, you don't get anything. And so she was kind of pissed about it, frankly. He has this huge hit. He doesn't credit her specifically. Again, he may, who knows how aware he even was of her version. And so she doesn't get a lot out of it.
I think that's a great point that you just made. I think a lot of songwriters are happy to have their songs covered because obviously it means more money in their bank account, especially if the song does well. But there have been instances of songwriters who have dissed cover versions of songs, even though they have sold scads of copies. It was almost like a condescending, this artist wasn't worthy of that song. You know, I can't believe they butchered it.
They cashed the checks, attitude. But they made that complaint.
Exactly. They didn't complain that loudly.
Yeah, but I do remember, like, especially around the punk new wave era when, for example, some of Elvis Costello's songs were being covered.
'Cause I don't know if you are loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine.
He would cast aspersions at some of these artists who were covering. I think Linda Ronstadt was, you know, got in his sights once for a cover of one of his songs.
Prince hated covers of his songs.
Yeah.
Like that's how sort of I open my book is he's trashing the art of the cover song, basically saying don't cover any of my songs, which is of course ironic because any number of Prince songs were hits from covers, from Cyndi Lauper, When You Were Mine, to Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You.
Nothing compares. Nothing compares.
Right.
There have been a million hit Prince covers, but, you know, he was always sort of contrary, and so he hated people covering his songs.
And then you've got an artist like Bob Dylan who, you know, the Basement Tapes are essentially, those songs were all written with the idea that somebody else would perform them. They were never intended to be released. They were basically songs that were, you know, here's a demo, record my song, please, make it a hit, and I'll gladly collect the income.
Yeah, he made it a business model where he recorded these demos. His manager would farm them out. And so many famous Dylan songs, for instance, The Mighty Quinn, you know, Quinn the Eskimo, were released by the cover version, Manfred Mann in that case, before Dylan's version ever came out.
Come without, come
I mean, and Dylan's an interesting case. He's the only artist in the book that gets two chapters about covers of his song.
You've got Adele doing him and of course, Hendrix.
Because he's so pivotal in the cover world, because he's someone who writes these great songs, but his actual recordings of them are, shall we say, not mass appeal. He's not having number one hits with his own recordings, but when people with a more commercially palatable voice do them, then they become number one hits.
It does confuse me, Ray, to some extent. I think modern musicians are well aware that sample at your own risk, because you can build a fantastic track out of a sample, but without getting the artist, I mean, it's not going to come out on any sort of legal form without getting the artist's permission, right? But we can cover whatever we want as long as we're paying royalties. But there are several famous incidents throughout history of a band in New York in the 80s, Das Damen, covered Magical Mystery Tour at a point where Michael Jackson owned that part of the Beatles catalog, and SST Records had to take back everything that was in the stores and destroy them.
As long as you don't change a word, you can cover whatever you want. You just have to pay the royalty. So in that case, either it could be they didn't, go through the proper channels to pay the royalty, or it could be if you change even a single word, all of a sudden you need permission. And there's an example of that in the book, which is the Fugees doing Killing Me Softly. They wanted to cover the song. They loved the song. They even went as far as recording it, but they had changed one line. They had changed the chorus from Killing Me Softly with a song to Killing the Sound Boy with his song. And Soundboy was sort of a Jamaican-influenced hip-hop, you could say wannabe. It was a diss, basically. So, I'm going to kill him, with how much better my song is. So they only changed those two words, Killing Me Softly to Killing the Soundboy, but then they need to go get permission. And the original writers said, hell no. You can't record Killing the Soundboy. If you record it, you have to do it the exact same way. So then they had to go back and re-record Killing Me Softly. But I spoke to Praz for the book, and he basically said, thank God they said no, because otherwise no one knows what Killing the Soundboy meant. It would have stayed within a small hip-hop niche, and instead it became our biggest song. That has been a hit for both Roberta Flack, who was covering a country pop song, and she made it into this, powerful soul song. And then 20 years later, the Fugees bring it into the realm of hip-hop with Lauryn Hill singing the song over basically a hip-hop beat that they took from Tribe Called Quest.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see.
And so you can say that's a song that, even though the original version by Lori Lieberman was not a hit,
killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song.
It's such a good song that it just transcends and can be covered over and over and over again.
In myriad styles.
And each version stands on its own.
With his song.
Well, thank you so much. Ray Padgett has been our guest on Sound Opinions, talking about covers in relation to his book, Cover Me. Thanks so much, Ray, for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, Greg and I'll share some of our favorite cover songs in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.